Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Dr. Daryl Smith from the Claremont Graduate University. And sometimes you introduce a speaker and their accomplishments are so extensive that if you go through all of their credentials and publications and so forth, I'm afraid we'd never get to Daryl's presentation. So I'm going to skip all the formalities if I can, and there are most of them, and talk a little bit more personally about my experience working with Daryl. As Jorge said, I've had the good fortune of working with Daryl and knowing her for over 15 years now. I met Daryl when I was a young, believe it or not, young graduate student in the doctoral program at the Claremont Graduate University in the early 1990s, almost said the early 1900s, but the early 1990s. And I had Daryl as a professor in a couple of courses. She also supervised one of my qualifying exams, and I was fortunate enough to have her as a member of my dissertation committee as well. And I can tell you that amongst all the students in our cohort, she had the universal respect of all of us. And we used to joke, you know, if you wrote a paper for Daryl and you used a citation, you better make sure you cite it properly and you describe it properly. Because there seemed to be nothing written about higher education that Daryl hadn't read herself or at least knew about, so we couldn't sneak anything past her. But she was great not only in the sense of being a professor and fulfilling that role, but I think the other roles of being a scholar, researcher, of being a mentor who supported us on a much more individual and personal basis, and also being a change agent. And it's in that latter role that I believe we've asked Daryl to join us today and speak to us about diversifying the faculty for the next generation, an urgent imperative. And I will be a little bit more formal now and give you a few facts about Daryl. She's been a co-principal investigator on a major project for the James Irvine Foundation to evaluate the impact of the Campus Diversity Initiative. And this is a six-year, $29 million effort that's funded, that included 28 private colleges and universities in California, which is designed to increase access and success of historically underrepresented and low-income students, and to build the institutional capacity to develop and evaluate diversity efforts. And I think these words resonate with a lot of us that have been at UC San Diego for a number of years, that have been involved in the university's challenge to try to increase and maintain its diversity. Daryl has also conducted research on faculty hiring, including such influential articles as Interrupting the Usual, Successful Strategies for Diversifying the Faculty, and also The Revolving Door for Underrepresented Minority Faculty in Higher Education. And Daryl's worked with a number of foundations, including the Ford, Hewlett, Pew, Spencer, and Irvine Foundations, the National Science Foundation, the United States Department of Education, and on many Western Association of Schools and Colleges accreditation teams. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Daryl Smith.
Thank you, Patrick. It's always a treat to be here and to see you, and it's always a treat to be back at UCSD. I'm going to just jump in, and I hope you're going to begin to see by my remarks that I feel rather urgently about this, and I hope by the end of my remarks you're going to feel as urgent as I do about UCSD, where you are and where you need to be. The Diversifying the Faculty for the Next Generation, an Urgent Imperative, is indeed an urgent imperative, because the next generation of faculty is now being hired, and I actually will modify that for you, has already been hired, a good chunk of it. And I have your data, and I hope to show you why this is so important, that the business as usual needs to be interrupted when it comes to faculty hiring. And what I'm going to do, because the basis, you know, I spent 20-some years as administrator and have been spending 20-some years as a faculty member. The basis of what I'm going to talk about today is research. And in the beginning part of my talk, I'm going to rush through research. This is not a research talk. You won't hear about methodology. If you want to know more about it, easily available to talk about. But I do want to give you some sense of what the basis of what I will say is for campuses in practical terms. The other thing I want to start out by laying as a context is what happens with faculty hiring in particular, and I've been around higher education long enough, I'm an academic, is everybody points the finger everywhere else. So you will typically hear chancellors, presidents, and such saying, or provosts even, what can I do? I don't hire faculty. Because faculty hiring, unlike many things related to diversity, are highly decentralized phenomena. And if how many of you have been on search committees and you love the opportunity to be on a search committee, right? And if you get drawn into chairing a search committee, you love that even more. And the reality then becomes, and I've had that, both those experiences, and I hate it. And the reality then is, in this highly decentralized, busy world in which we live, taking this on means as quick and as fast as I can do it, the better. So interrupting the usual is not very attractive. So what happens is, senior leadership will go, but that's a faculty thing, what can I do? And the reality is that what faculty do is very much influenced by the institutional context. So the framing function here is that the role of faculty diversity begins both at the department level and at the university level. And it's the alignment of all of those things that will fundamentally set the stage for what happens to be followed. And that's a very important thing to think about. Because the reality is, in our universities, faculty are key and hiring will be key. So there have been a whole bunch of studies I've done, and I'm just laying them out here, and I'm going to give you sort of the snippets of them. The first study was one in which it really began as a national study because I spent a lot of time on college campuses. And on those campuses, I heard a lot of earnest, well-meaning people talking about why they hadn't made much progress on faculty diversity. At the same time, I live in pretty diverse communities of people who had very different views on why there had not been so much progress on it. So I want to just give you the nugget of that one. Then I began a study in which I said, so under what conditions are faculty of color, particularly underrepresented faculty of color, hired? It's an empirical question, assuming we could get the data. And I got some data. And then this Irvine project that Patrick mentioned has been really about building capacity and monitoring progress. How do you know you're making progress when diversity is about so many things? And out of that study came a lot of information about that we hadn't understood and has now been validated across the country in many other institutions about hiring, the hiring rate, and turnover. The bottom line, we have got to interrupt the usual and the assumed if we're going to make progress. So what are the reasons we typically give for why we're not making progress on faculty diversity? Oh, come on.
Pipeline.
There aren't any. They wouldn't want to come here. We couldn't afford them. There are so few that there are bidding wars going after them, going into industry where they're much better paid. There's just no hope for white males anymore, particularly heterosexual white males. And in the sciences especially, there are so few that there's no chance they would want to come here. Those are statements that really most campuses function as if they're fact. Study I did demonstrated that they're largely fiction. And it's very important to begin to think about and hear as you're sitting in meetings and groups when things that sound like mythology begin to come up. So you see them here. There are so few, sciences especially. Well, it turns out in this study that I did, the scientists had a harder time being hired. Because in fact, what happens in the sciences is that there is less sense in which, why is this relevant to us? We just hire the best. And if it happens to be somebody who adds diversity, wonderful. And what we found in our study is the scientists of color in particular were having a terrible time finding academic positions and often went into industry because they couldn't find jobs. And my favorite example of that, and I won't give you any more information because you could trace him and find out, was a Chicano geophysicist who had gotten his degree at an elite place, trust me. So I want to stop and let you think. Chicano geophysicist. Not your typical image. This man was committed to an academic career, applied for over 100 positions, and got no job offers. Finally went into industry because at some point you got to get a life. That's the story that goes with a larger set of data about these myths, which continue to play out on campuses, leaving academia for more lucrative positions. What we heard in this study was much more about we didn't feel well treated, we didn't feel taken seriously, we went into industry where people seemed to understand what our value was. And here's the sort of culminating quote from this study from a Latina I'd say I find it a little surprising that I do not regularly get phone calls. We are so few. It's amazing that most universities will say, we can't find anybody. But I think I should be getting phone calls, but I'm not getting phone calls. The nub of this study was that we interviewed over 300 national fellowship winners who turned out to have been 93% of them got their degrees at the elite research universities and Ivy League institutions. So this was a very elite group, very diverse group. 11% of them in the end had what we called a bidding experience. And by that, it meant they had usually two job offers, often from places that they didn't particularly care to go to. And sometimes they negotiated summer stipends, computers, and salaries a little. But this was not the notion that most campuses are functioning with, that is, people are sitting back and saying, gee, where do I want to teach? And I'll just let them know I'm available and they'll scoop me up. Just was not true. The second study is very important, because it's really, and it's just one sheet of paper and colors. So the important thing here is it's really asking, under what conditions are faculty of color hired, particularly historically underrepresented faculty? And the hypothesis of this study was that something that interrupted the usual, so a target of opportunity search, a job description that put diversity at the center of it, or some combination thereof, would more likely lead to hiring than a regular search process. We had three major research universities, you would be happy to have them if I could name them, but I promise not to name them, provide us with all the information from 750 searches over a three-year period so we could understand under what conditions people were hired. I mean, it was remarkable. It's an interesting story as to why these campuses would have spent so much time getting us our data. But the important thing here that I want to show you is that light blue is a regular search. The dark red is an interruption. So the important thing here is this is African Americans. 14% were hired by the regular search. The rest were hired as a function of diversity in the job description, a special hire, or some combination. 86% of the African Americans in this study were hired with a process that was not the usual search process. This is American Indians. How much blue? 100% hired with some kind of an intervention strategy, none hired in a regular search process. Latinos, 57% regular search. Now, I should say that our definition of job description was mostly things like ethnic studies. If we had included, and we went back and actually reanalyzed the data, the job description having language would have counted as a special job description, this blue would have been much smaller. So if you were hired for a language department as a Latino, you were in this regular search. Well, that overstates the regular search by a lot. Asian Americans and whites more likely to be in terms of regular searches. And what's important here from a legal point of view is that whites were also hired with special opportunity hires and diversity in the job description. So it is not a case where these are processes that were available and used by all groups of people. But the reality is, if you wanted to interrupt the usual, if you wanted to change the pattern, doing the usual wasn't going to do it. Some kind of intervention strategy was going to be required in order to make a difference here. Now, when we did this study, this was in the last few years, it's become really important to disaggregate international faculty, which was not done in this study. And you'll see that for your data in a little bit. The pattern would have been quite different for Asians here had we done that. But we didn't do that at the time. So the bottom line here is interrupting the usual. Intervention strategies, job descriptions that engage the question of diversity in some kind of serious way. I read all the job descriptions for 750 searches, and in my field of social psychology, those job descriptions could have been written in the 1950s. They had not functionally changed, even though the world has changed quite a lot. So the question of job descriptions, and in the sciences, this becomes an interesting challenge, because in history and literature, we can imagine what putting diversity in the core of the expertise would be. But it turns out that if you begin to think about what do you need in a science faculty member in terms of their competence and experience in working with diverse groups of people and in success of students and historically underrepresented students in the science fields, you get a very different pool and a very different discussion than the usual science job descriptions. So this is about expertise and competence. And that is very important because there is nothing illegal about specifying the expertise and the competence you want in a job description. The other thing that's come out of a whole series of studies is this question of why. Why is faculty diversity important? But it's terribly important, it turned out, because our rationales that even those of us who are doing this work and committed to it use is very a weak rationale when it comes to a pervasive rationale for faculty diversity. And there are a number of rationales here that are terribly important. The first one is the mission. If we can't understand why having a diverse faculty is critical to the mission of a place like UCSD, then diversity in hiring is going to be something you get if it's nice, if you can, lovely, but not something as a strategic imperative. And so part of the challenge for any campus is to understand its mission, what its purpose is, and ask why is diversity important to it. So for example, I'm part of a national project now that's being based at Harvard Medical School on the issue of the diversity in the health professions and by extension the STEM fields. It's quite clear that we have a national crisis with respect to the diversity of people coming into the STEM and medical fields. Many people are coming into universities interested in those and leaving without that. So what is UCSD's role in the production and capacity building of the nation and the state in these fields? And to what degree does faculty diversity play a role in this and diversity in general? The institutional credibility and capacity in its decision making. Credibility. We now know as a country, because of the changing demographics, that there's something very suspicious when a group of people look like all white men, or even white men and women. And it's sort of now known, we're sort of in the schizophrenic time where we've got people reacting, but it's clear that even in national politics, even in the Supreme Court, that we can't have groups look homogenous in the way that they once did. The credibility and the integrity of the processes come under suspicion when there's not some sense that all groups of people represented in the population have some long-term access and success and talent identification in these arenas. And that's nowhere more critical than in the faculty. We like to think that the future faculty is a function of a pipeline. But I have to ask you, why would you go into any field in which that field thought that it could never find talent in the form of someone who looked like you, if you were representing diversity? So the issue of attractiveness, credibility, integrity are critically important. And a good example of this would be for decision making. Let's assume you had an executive vice chancellor who was a physicist. And I have no idea. I did this once on a campus, and they did, and there was an issue. And began to hire people for the senior cabinet who were all physicists, scientists. I know you must have tension here between science and the humanities and the arts. I just know you must. Is that true? Okay. So you get a senior leader who makes sure that surrounds them all scientists. What happens? Jump in. What happens? How do the faculty feel about it? A lot of suspicion. Suspicion why?
That people are being excluded, that they're going to make decisions based on only being scientists or physicists.
So part of it is the credibility and the trust and the integrity. Even if those physicists and scientists were going to really, because they love the humanities and the arts, were going to really work hard to make sure it's an all-inclusive decision process, the fact is there would be this sense of trust that comes from seeing that nobody that represents your interest is sitting there. The other is deep knowledge about experiences in life. Our deep knowledge. So, you know, I might be a well-meaning white woman, but the fact is that I'm going to have to work really hard to know enough to think that I could sit in a room and bring all the perspectives that are needed. In fact, it would be quite exhausting. So the issue of decision capacity and decision trust is very much a function of who's sitting around the table. The culture and the climate and the attractiveness of an institution. I can tell you now that because of the changing demographics in our society, that an institution that is not diverse is becoming less and less attractive. I've seen faculty of color, for example, turn down positions in elite faculty departments because of the lack of diversity in students and the lack of diversity in colleagues, and go to places where they feel they can make a real difference in terms of the diversity of a community and building capacity, say, in science, and they just won't put up with that. So attractiveness. At the undergraduate level, increasingly we're hearing students of every racial and ethnic background talk about looking around the campus, and if it feels very diverse, it's a much more attractive place than if it doesn't. This is true among white middle-class folks. It is just we're at an era in the 21st century where being a diverse institution at every level is a more attractive institution. So if you begin to look at yield data, both on terms of hiring and students, and you see low yields, you want to say, are we as attractive as we might otherwise be? Societal needs, this group at the Harvard Medical School and STEM, and we're reaching a crisis in terms of the diversity of needs in the STEM fields and in terms of medical fields that are going to rest on having diverse people doing research. The fact is that we know that people from diverse backgrounds do a different kind of research. They tend to bring their life experience. They're committed to communities. We need that. You can't do urban planning and not expect to have some diverse group of folks. Community health is a huge issue now. And the question is, do we have the competence in medical education, not just because we have doctors from diverse backgrounds, but also just in general for medical education? Do we have the competence in our medical fields to serve the diverse communities that constitute the United States today? Terribly important, and that goes to issues of education and research. Now, role models and mentors are the usual reasons we give for faculty diversity, and there is no question that having a diverse faculty says there's a sense of possibility for me. It also says to people who are not from that background, people from that group can be physicists. How many people have seen an African-American physicist? You have. Good. Important, is it not? You took note of it. How many of your students have? We signal a lot about where we think talent resides, in what form talent lives, by the absence of diversity. And this functions not only in terms of retention for students, but retention for all. In a minute, you'll see a turnover issue here. Well, retention is also a function of what's people's experience in their departments. I'll say it again later, but I can tell you, as having looked at your data across all departments, there are a lot of zeros and ones for both women and for underrepresented faculty. In so many departments, people are the only one. This is not a healthy environment for most of us to live. The key here, I think, is not that there's some magical ratio. I mean, we've often said we have to have diverse faculty for students. We imagine that the demographic of the faculty should match the demographic of the student. We talk as if a good white male faculty can't be a mentor to students. That's not true. The significance here is the absence of. There are too many zeros and ones. It signals a great deal when there is nobody, or maybe the one exception. That is the compelling issue. And until we have thorough diversity on the faculty, we're going to be dealing with zeros and ones and with a heavy emphasis on we've got to diversify the faculty. I should say there's a legal implication. If we all run around scurry worrying about 209 and legal suits. If I look at the history of hiring in most universities, I would say there's a discrimination lawsuit waiting to happen. How is it that we can have whole departments who have never hired or retained or tenured an underrepresented faculty member of color? And wouldn't that be prime fodder for a discrimination lawsuit? But somehow we forget about that imperative while we're worrying about 209. Now I want to very quickly go to these other findings about the diversity of hiring, the hiring rate overall, and the turnover, because it's a terribly significant set of findings that's really important for all of you. The fact is that we've been studying new hires. That is, what are the pattern of hiring of new people? Because the demographics of a whole faculty is only going to shift more slowly than the new hires. And in fact, what we found was that the new hires tended to be more diverse than the existing faculty demographic. Sometimes people would say, well, we're not hiring very much, and so the big faculty demographic isn't going to change very quickly. Well, the other thing we found is that the hiring rate overall has been quite robust. On most of the campuses we did in our study, but this has been confirmed lately, a third to one-half the faculty has been hired in about a 5 to 8 year period. I'll have your numbers in a minute. which means the robust hiring. We've been doing a lot of hiring. So that led us, I spent a lot of time looking at the overall faculty demographics and then the hiring patterns and thinking, gee, why isn't it changing faster than it should? I mean, it should have changed faster, not fast, but faster. Well, we began to realize that there was a bit of a turnover issue. That is, a lot of the faculty being hired were going to replace people who left. So I had a wonderful moment, because mathematics was my undergraduate major, where I got to use equation editor in Word. And I came up with what I call the turnover quotient. Now, this is the formula. A turnover quotient of 0 means every new hire went to add diversity to the faculty. A turnover quotient of 100% meant that all the underrepresented new hires, or whatever group you're talking about, went to replace people who left. In other words, if faculty hiring is so hard, why would we want to have the retention issues we do? And what we have discovered is most campuses don't know they have that issue. If they do, that's really good, and I think you probably do. So let me translate this lovely equation, because you don't have to write it down. I never use it when I'm calculating, when I calculated your turnover. So you have 3 Latino faculty. I'll keep the numbers simple. And you hire 3. How many should you have?
6.
But you only have 4. How many did you lose?
2.
So 2 out of the 3 you hired went to replace people who left. And so that is, what's 2/3 as a percent? You're good. So turnover quotient of about 66%. 2/3, right? So that's what that means. So the research on faculty diversity, in a quick leap, it's been very slow to change. This is something terribly important now. Not only is the next generation being hired, but your international faculty are growing the fastest. And this is something that's new in my analysis of all data now, is to work really hard to get the international numbers. Because, in fact, this is very, very important. The hiring of international faculty, despite the fact that that's not easy, we have to go through visas and we have to pay money and we have to do all kinds of things. In fact, we're hiring international faculty faster than we're hiring domestic faculty. There's been returner and retention. We now know that graduate student diversity is a critical issue here. When we looked at campuses, the graduate student diversity wasn't much better than the faculty diversity, which means higher education creates its own labor market. Isn't that interesting? We create our own labor market, and our labor market isn't much more diverse than our faculty. And that's partly, I think, because graduate student diversity, like faculty hiring, is a highly diverse, a highly decentralized phenomenon. And we're not much better at identifying talent in graduate students than we are in faculty candidates. There are lots of myths and reasons. We have more reasons than myths about why we haven't made progress than can fill up several pages. We have the story of one good year. I can't tell you how many campuses I've been on where people say, we were very successful. We hired 3 faculty of color. And then you look at the data, and they did that year. And it's as if everybody sits back, says, oh, wasn't that a fantastic year, and then goes back to the usual, and you get the usual results. So the story of one good year is a real phenomenon in many campuses. So this is about identifying talent and interrupting the usual. So let me spend a little time on UCSD. And I'm not a graph person. So what I asked for was the ladder rank faculty. So these are full-time ladder rank faculty by race and ethnicity. And your data, and one of these days we're going to move to race by gender, has women and minorities. And what that means is poor women of color sort of get lost in one of those phenomena. But the bottom line here is between 2000 and 2008, the underrepresented minority faculty have gone from 6 to 7%. Asian faculty from 11 to 16%. 0% American Indian. Now, this was the initial data I got from UCSD. There's no international faculty here, but so this was my first analysis. So in 8 years, historically underrepresented groups up by 1%. Not robust. Now, some critical pieces of information between 2000 and 2008. Between 2000 and 2008, your faculty size grew by 21%. This faculty is 1/5 larger now than it was in 2000. So this is robust hiring. underrepresented minorities from 6% to 7%. You've got no disaggregation for international faculty. Now, here's the other data point I want you to know. New hires represent 48% of the 2008 faculty. You have hired in 8 years 580 faculty. If I take it as a percentage of your current faculty size, that's 48%. If I take it as the percentage of where you were in 2000, it's well over half. You have, if we think about that as sort of the next generation, just in this 8-year period, you've hired half your faculty. That assumes another 8 years to finish it off before you're set with the next generation of faculty. That's not even assuming that before 2000, you also were hiring, which you were. This is very alarming to me, and it ought to be to you, that you are going through the fastest pace of generation replacement and not making much more progress on diversification than was true 20 years ago. In a world that is far more diverse, in a state, in a UC that's going to ask you, what are you doing in terms of hiring of faculty. I also calculated your turnover quotient. That is, I had the new hires during this period, I had where you started in 2000, and I had where you ended up in 2008. The turnover quotient for women, 51%. That means about half of the women you hired went to replace people who left. For men, it was 69%. Now, I don't put the turnover for white men, for whites, because to me, that's the generation that's retiring. So you'd expect in fact, you would expect that the turnover quotient for whites would be above, that is, you're not hiring enough to replace them. What this means is you're still replacing all the white men that were there. 3 out of the 4 new white hires are going to replace people who left. Not 100%, not 200%. So actually, you are hiring whites. Now, if we disaggregated and intersected whites and gender, we might see something about white women versus white men. Black turnover, 71%. So almost 3/4 of the people you hire. If this is such a rare group, so valued, so special, when you get them, why would you want people to leave? Hispanic, 20%. So that's a fairly low number. That suggests that most people are staying. But we're going to have to put a little caveat for that in a minute. American Indian. Now, N is very small with American Indians. You had one. You hired one. You had one at the end. That's a turnover quotient of 100%. That means the one person you hired went to replace the person who left. I don't know if in that same department, but just as an institution overview. And Asian, 30%. Now, when you start getting, you can decide what's a high enough turnover or what's a natural turnover. And again, no myths and excuses, please. What tends to happen is, well, they're all getting bitted after, sought after. Poor UC, can't pay anybody anymore, and Harvard's eating them all up. What I know from going to campuses is that people are not telling the truth about why they're leaving because they don't want to burn bridges. So the question is, how does an institution begin to really understand what's going on? Obviously, some of this is retirement. Fair enough. The job for an institution is to know what its retention is and then to do the work that says, what is the explanation of this? And if there's an explanation that seems perfectly reasonable, fine. But just make sure you're not deluded. Now, I added this slide actually last night because I thought, I've got more data here. So I really got worried about this international thing because it looked like that you were making progress with Latino faculty. Considerable progress, and I was thinking, oh, good. But I was really worrying about this international thing. So I asked for, and I said, I know I can't get it for the 2000 and stuff. Give me what you can get. So what I got was the disaggregation, including citizenship, for the new hires for the 2008-09 year, so last year. There were 84 hires. 37% of them were international faculty. 37% of your new hires. When I did the reanalysis for the new hires, underrepresented minority new hires, that is not international, were just 5%. So you're not going forward if that's what your hiring pattern is. And indeed, something that I think ought to be shocking is there were 6 Latinos, 5 of them were international. So whatever sense of, oh, aren't we making great progress on Latino-Chicano faculty, the fact is...
Can I just ask?
Yeah.
On the definition of international, does that mean faculty who are not American citizens, irrespective of degree, or does it mean individuals who have their degrees from outside the United States?
This is your university data. Does John want to say what?
What we did was identify from the personal payroll system those people which were coded C, being U.S. citizens, and then there are a couple of other codes, permanent residents, things like that. So what I provided to Dr. Smith was this amount are coded as C, and everyone else is non-C. So where they got their degree, I don't know.
Okay.
And, you know, you can, for example, one of the data points that I've been very troubled about is when I looked at the survey of earned doctorates, all the PhDs, you know, that 87% of all Asians are non-citizens. And when I looked at their data, green cards count as citizen. I mean, it's non. These are international students here on F1 or student visas. So this is, you know, we can get into a squirmish game about, well, but what about somebody who was born somewhere else and came? You know, all of those things. The complexity of boxes is a complex thing, and we've got to be able to engage the complexity. But it's quite clear here that, and again, you could know the individual identity of all of these six and decide whether they count. But the point is, international faculty certainly add diversity. I mean, we're in a global world. Am I better off by knowing somebody from South Africa? Absolutely. But when we look at our own domestic, and just looking at the Asian production in PhDs, we're in deep trouble. And in terms of our students and their own sense of, is there a future for me? Why would you go into the academy as a faculty member? Why would you go and be a scientist if the demography of science looks primarily white, male, and foreign? So there are a lot of reasons here. But the fact is that if there's tension on the campus, one of the things that gets me is you'll have cross tensions. A leader will stand up and say, look at the progress we've made on Chicano Latino faculty and the Chicano Latino community. Instead of saying, yes, aren't we good, we'll get there and go, not anybody I saw lately. And I went through your data, and I looked at all the Chicano Latino Hispanic look in engineering and in science, and I thought, wow, you've been identifying talent in some very unusual fields. Well, turns out they're mostly international. So overall, what this means, I could do the 2008, I couldn't do the 2000. What it means is the underrepresented, historically underrepresented minority faculty is 5% of your faculty, not 7% that I said. And your international faculty overall is 23%. So I just made a 2008. 5%, 23%, 62%, and not much progress over here. And I bet if you went back 20 years, 15 years, I don't think it would look much different than this. So it's clear that if one is going to make progress, it can't look like this. There are tons of strategies that you can use for searches. This cannot be just a department issue. It can't be just wipe out the old job description. There's got to be program planning and discussion at the program and department level and at the school level. What is it we need for a 21st century faculty? We understood this when we thought about faculty connections to industry and technology. We changed who we hired. So it cannot just be a department issue, even though hiring resides in departments. I'm not questioning that. I'm a faculty member. But it's got to be embedded in something bigger, and there's got to be leadership discussion at all levels to say, this is what we need, and folks, we need you to do it. The job description, the search committee, the special hire is clear. What's happened in every university I know, if someone holds back, particularly with a 21% increase, one could have held back a bunch of searches so that people weren't fighting over the same little crumb. One could have held back some of those searches, and maybe you still can, and say, if you find talent that adds to our diversity of expertise and what we're looking for in terms of adding to this, we're going to give you an extra line. And guess what happens when that happens? People find all kinds of wonderful people. It's got to be intentional. It's not going to happen because we do bureaucratic exercises on pieces of paper. It's not. It's got to be because it really matters. That the UC regents are looking at your faculty diversity numbers and saying to the president, this stinks. And hopefully the president goes to the chancellor and says, what's this about? This is not going to be an attractive place if you continue to have this demographic that you have. It's going to require leadership at all levels. This isn't just a chancellor and a dean thing. It's academic senate. It's department chairs. It's faculty leaders. This has got to be an academic core that says for the intellectual viability and vitality of our future, we need more diversity sitting around our table. The hiring issues are, you know, what we've seen in the research is champions. People need to find talent and then champion them. Because I can tell you that people, there are more reasons why people don't rise to the top than you can imagine in these searches. And there's plenty of evidence about that. In fact, there's really a sense that historically underrepresented groups, to some degree white women as well, get over-scrutinized in a way that white male faculty don't. And what counts as excellence? If what counts as excellence was what was taught and done in the 1950s, then your fields haven't changed. My fields changed dramatically. So what counts as excellence in my field better include diversity, or we're just in anachronism. The data. You need to monitor the data. At the senior levels, you'll be saying, how did we do on hiring? These are simple little charts, simple little tables. Overall, new hires, the conditions under which people are hired, retention and turnover, it takes three numbers to calculate turnover. The location, which departments and divisions are making progress, what could they teach the rest of the university? And I think increasingly, a race by gender, by citizenship. This notion of we have gender over here and ethnicity over here, it will not work. And the fact that you did not have and do not have now international faculty as part of that demographic is going to mislead you and cause great frustration. As people watch the international faculty grow, and there's nothing wrong with having a robust international faculty, but watch it grow and have it count and called racial and ethnic diversity. That is not the same thing. Retention, you've got to be able to hear the truth versus myths and assumptions, and there the question is who on your campus can hear the truth and convey it back to the leadership so they will hear it. The critical mass, we are so far from critical mass and where people live in the zeros and ones that it's very troubling. We know the differential burdens that people who are the tokens in, you know, the irony is the more committed you get to diversity, and you know you need diversity around your table in order to have a robust diversity discussion, the same few people who've been doing diversity in the staff or the faculty for the last 40 years now have six more committees to do. So from a... And one of the things we're observing on some of the research universities is that when often underrepresented faculty and white women are getting stuck at associate professors. So I don't know if you're watching that here, but some campuses are. And the theory, I think, is that we've learned how to protect junior faculty until they get tenure. But I think here's this, you know, 5%. 5%, it's a small number. Now we really are committed to diversity, we need you, and you no longer have to worry about tenure, so welcome to the committee world. So I think what we're doing is that burden is passing on, and in a research university, if you're not continuing to be productive, full professor is going to elude you, and there's enough data now emerging that this is a real problem, that the time we thought it was going to take 20 years ago for people to come in as assistant and make their way through full professor is not happening, and I think it's because of this. People need to be mentored, and they need to feel they matter intellectually, as a person, as an individual. And one of the things we're discovering is that people need to perceive that the institution is really committed to diversity, to feel like it's worth putting the effort in. This is not easy work. And if people don't perceive commitment, it can be very disheartening and pretty alienating. And that's turned out to be a very surprising finding in a lot of research. So, and perceptions of commitment don't get built with trust simply because someone says, aren't we committed to diversity or we're an inclusive community? It's committed to because you see diversity at senior levels all over the campus. So the implications at every level, you have to think about this as a systematic set of indicators, which are intelligent metrics. These are not, this is not academic research. These are intelligent metrics that say, are we making progress? And you've got to monitor the progress every year. And then there has to be some kind of an accountability feedback loop. It has to be understood in the core of your mission, not the same as Cal State LA or any other place. It's got to be your mission. There has got to be leadership and communication. There has got to be intentionality. The minute you take your eye off this one, it goes away. And it's got to be inclusive and differentiated. And I focused here on race and ethnicity because it's the hardest, and hiring, it's the hardest nut. But clearly we've got to do women intersecting with race. You'll see very different stories here because, in fact, if you look at PhD production, women of color are one of the fastest growing groups in a lot of PhD fields. And that gets all lost in this way of framing this. So I will conclude. It's urgent. We are hiring now the next generation for an entire generation. And it is going to reside and make a difference for the intellectual institutional capacity for excellence in a diverse society and a diverse state. Your credibility as an institution in the state, in the system, in the society, and what you contribute to the national issues with respect to a healthy democracy is going to rest on who you think talent is and where it resides. Thank you. So the question is, what about the sticks when people go through motions and nothing changes? You know, I'm an academic, and the traditional notions of carrots and sticks sometimes can backfire, so you have to be careful. So one of the things you want to make sure is that a leader doesn't get out. You know, a chancellor says, I will not approve any hire that's not, well, that's a dead on arrival. But I do know that the academic world is very sensitive to new trends when they think it's real. Why have we got nano everything going all around the country? Why? Because it's the new thing and the institutions are supporting it. It infuriates me, frankly, that in this time of budget crisis, where we're laying people off, I keep watching as I go from campus to campus, new global initiatives being launched very strategically. They are launched as initiatives and campaigns. They're not just random little things that we do. So a kind of coherent sense that this is an imperative for this institution and we're moving forward, all of a sudden gets faculty and others kind of reading the tea leaves. And they want to be part of the place where there might be some resources as opposed to left on the outs. That happened with technology, absolutely. It's happening with all kinds of transdisciplinary work in the sciences. But that's not what we do with diversity. There's nothing campaignish about it. It's about, we've got a little rhetoric, then we say the faculty have to do it, and nothing. So I think the accountability lenses, what I dream of is you have a set of indicators. For faculty, I've given you the list of what those indicators should be. The chancellor, see now the president's getting it from the UC regions, so the chancellor now has it for the campus as a whole. My dream, the chancellor says to her cabinet, this is where we are making progress and this is where we're not making progress. Not good enough, folks. Then that team, who doesn't do faculty hiring, includes the executive vice chancellor and whomever else sits with that group. And now we have a conversation with the deans. And you know it matters without hard sticks. This is not going to work. What can I do to be helpful? There's a little carrot. Or is it clear, for example, that the diversity you now have, those departments are being appreciated for the work they've done? Probably not. So I think it's a much more subtle, it's not a bureaucratic mechanism. It's something that's got to be aligned with academic culture. But it's got to have more accountability and teeth than you've got now. And it's certainly not going to be rhetoric and, well, that's a faculty thing. Oh, dear. So sorry.
How do you correlate the argument about global initiative and globalization with your earlier distinction between international and indigenous underrepresented?
Well, I think, years ago, I decided, what my view about higher education is we've always been enamored by the international. Always. And so I made a distinction some years back. I'm the domestic diversity person. That is not to say I don't understand that international perspectives bring a great deal to our kind of micro, narrow-looking sense of the world. Because of immigration, our world is much more complicated now. That binary, just like with gender, doesn't live so tightly anymore. And my worry actually is it's going to get messier and messier, and we won't have solved this problem. But every community outside and inside this university knows who's who. So I think what you do is you've got, in fact, with such robust hiring, you could have increased your international faculty, and you could have increased your historically underrepresented faculty, and you could have increased white women in science and math, and had a faculty that began to look more thoroughly diverse. So that's what I think about that, is to put it over here and not confound the racial and ethnic categories. And I was giving a talk to the MIT 9 group, and somebody thought I was being anti-international, a senior administrator, and really took me to task for that. And I actually am doing some comparative work. I really am not anti-international. But what says to me is we know how to hire differently. It takes a lot of work to hire an international faculty member. We don't seem to worry about all that extra work. But when it comes to domestic faculty members in our own backyard, so to speak, oh, it's just hard. So the other thing I would say about numbers is, and I think the UCs are very vulnerable to this, you use your affirmative action numbers as population, how many people are available and therefore how many should be here. usually by PhDs or something. You don't use that same criteria when you go to hire Nobel Prize winners. You've got a huge overrepresentation of Nobel Prize winners here. You want to have a huge overrepresentation of Nobel Prize winners here, and you, in fact, are proud of it, and you know how to do it. And they're not a dime a dozen. They're not some random. I mean, the problem with the affirmative action availability numbers is it's as if we think the searches are you put everybody in a box, you close your eyes, and you pick it out. What's the probability that we're going to get a historic, well, depending upon what the demographics. But that's not what we do with Nobel. We want talent and excellence. We want people who are going to bring new perspectives and all of this that we now need in a 21st century university. And we're going to go find them. And we don't really care if there's only two African Americans who got their PhD last year. In fact, there are a ton of them, and many of them are at places like Spelman and Bennett, because those are the only places that know what talent looks like in mathematics. It doesn't look like traditional folks. So that's the framing switch that I would do. I hope I answered your question. Okay?
Patrick. Just a comment, just to put this, I think, in a broader context. I really appreciate the comments you made about the internationalization and the separating out. And there is a group of us, Jorge and myself and a number of Chicanos here in San Diego County, that represent all the different four-year institutions in this county. And then our analysis, that's exactly what we're seeing. It's not just in faculty hiring, but it's been used by institutions in a sense to say this is our increasing diversity.
Right.
And we see it in the way that education abroad programs and international centers are getting bigger and increasing while equity programs like EOP are being cut. And we see it in the faculty. We also see it in the recruitment of students. And the reality for our community is that we know that the international Latino faculty will not be likely to take an interest in mentoring our students or recruiting our students or researching our communities or doing curriculum that reflects our community. So they don't play a lot of the functions that we really find crucial in the kind of faculty that we're looking for. And it's again part of a much bigger...
Well, and I think the way I would suggest the next generation is to... You framed it as faculty in the service of a community. Well, faculty are not hired in service of communities, mostly. The question for me is, why is that faculty in service of the viability of the University of California, San Diego, as it moves forward? And I would say that not only does it have those functions that you describe, but the credibility and the viability of this institution will rest. I've seen more communities and donors and politicians now look at the absence of diversity in so many faculties and say, you're not the university we need for the 21st century. And so I think we've got to say that this is unconscionable, just as it would be. Let us imagine, because we seem to get gender in this way. The advanced program understands that the gender issues are not pipeline, they're not quality, they're transformation of the institution. When it comes to underrepresented racial groups, it's all about pipeline and quality and availability. So the reality is, let's imagine we had a university today that had no women in the faculty. I mean, you actually got quite a few departments that look pretty close to that. But I think it's becoming increasingly uncomfortable to justify that based on any grounds. Because what it says is this is not an attractive field. Why would we want more diverse people going into our fields if we say this isn't an attractive thing? I think it goes very much to the knowledge production, the future labor production, the future leadership production in the sciences, absolutely, the future leadership production in science, is all going to rest on whether elite universities who care about science, math, medicine, et cetera, start doing this seriously in the way that we seem to start doing international seriously. I mean, in a budget time, why would we be doing Dubai? It's lovely to do Dubai. But do you see what effort it takes and why those international efforts require leadership at every level? It requires faculty, it requires department chairs and deans and the chancellor and the EVC. All of those folks are on board about that. There is nothing equivalent to that with faculty hiring, and there could be. Thank you all very, very much. I appreciate your patience.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.